This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Thrilled today to be joined by one of the most brilliant leaders I get a chance to visit with. We're joined today by Tom McGrath. And Tom, in addition to be a leader at Cornell and a great health system, he's also a great thinker. And we're going to talk today about some of his core thoughts, rules to live by, how he looks at things and so forth. And then we'll do a separate podcast that speaks separately about Medicare Advantage plans and some of the things he's seeing there. Today we're going to talk about Tom, or what we call Tomism, some of his thoughts. Tom, can you take a moment and introduce yourself?
Sure, happy to, Scott. I'm the director of planning at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City. I've had a 25-year career in healthcare around the country, really, in Florida, California, as well as spent most of my time in Illinois, in Chicago.
Talk a little bit. You've come up with over the years, sort of what I think of as rules to live by. And take a moment on maybe a couple of those that you view as the most important to sort of living life or doing great or working within a great professional organization or building great organizations. You talk, for example, about some simple concepts, great ones adjust. Talk about what that means, great ones adjust.
Right. So the history of these Tomisms is I would frequently orient new managers, new clinical leaders, new administrative leaders, many of whom, you know, came up as scientists or clinicians and didn't have experience with leadership. And, you know, a lot of them stuck and I could tell that they were sticking with people. So I started writing them down. They kind of fall into a number of different themes regarding communication, flexibility, responsibility, simplicity. That's something I focus on all the time. And the great ones adjust, you know, kind of speaks basically to flexibility. You know, the world changes, the situations that you're encountering, one day could be flipped on their head. By the time you show up in your office, all the things that you had planned to work on that week, the 10 items, could go out the window because some new crisis hits your, desk. And, you know, it was something that somebody shared with me, you know, when they were going through a challenging period. And, you know, it just kind of underscores that, you know, change is inevitable. And those who adjust manage that change well, whereas those that don't can really struggle. So, you know, it's a pithy little one-liner. You know, sometimes it's good to, you know, include at the top of a presentation or a budget narrative, but it kind of just drives home the point that, you know, change is inevitable and we all need to adjust with it to be great.
Thank you. You also have one of your Tomisms is this concept, and it seems so true to me. It's sort of whenever somebody says they're not doing something, you almost know that they're doing it. And it's almost one of the things I love is when people say, I'm a person who never complains, but... And I think there's so much truth in that, but talk about that, where you've seen that, where you see this concept of someone says, I'm not doing that. And you always know when they say they are, it almost reminds me of a professional football coach says, I'm never leaving this team. And once they say it, I know they're leaving. I've seen it with my college coaches and so forth. But talk about this concept. I'm not doing X, but we know that then, in fact, they probably are. Talk about that for a second.
Yeah, you know, that was just introduced to me by a CEO of another organization that I was a part of. And, you know, he said to me once that his boss said to him, you know, I wasn't thinking of firing you over this occurrence, but, and then, you know, he knew his boss had thought about firing him over that occurrence. And to me, that's just more of a humorous one. Which I sometimes bring up when somebody introduces something to me and the first thing they say is, I'm not thinking about X. But it's something I share with managers who, when they lead in with me, that somebody has shared with them, you know, a comment like, I wasn't thinking about X. I just want to make sure that they understand that person really was thinking about X. Mostly though, that's sort of a humorous one, but it and it keeps the conversation on track.
And you have a concept that says beware of the good idea syndrome. Talk about what that means.
Right. So I've spent my career at academic medical centers and academic institutions. And the important part of academia and the college and the process of discovery is inclusiveness and having people at the table. And in these places, I'm working around the smartest people in the world, quite literally. And yet, much of what I do as an administrator is need to move the ball forward across the goal line. And so when you marry those two things together and you're trying to accomplish a task, renovate some space, open a new program, and at the same time you bring in the stakeholders and bring in these academic people who, they're paid to think, you'll get, a smorgasbord of ideas that, are good ideas, but they mean they're going to take the project in 12 different directions or add, 12 times the amount of time to complete the project. And they're good ideas, but it's just about, making sure that you limit the scope. I guess it's the same thing as, beware of scope creep. And, trying to, recognize that it's a good idea, but also recognize that you perfect is the enemy of good, and you've got to surround the project and box in the project to something that can be achievable.
Right. We have a concept in one of the companies I work with is that at some point in time, we're done with new ideas and we have to execute on what we have. And it seems like a tangent of what you're talking about is that there are a million different ideas, but at some point you have to execute on the plan you have and it's time for no new ideas.
Exactly. I mean, that's a perfect tangent. It's almost, in the Venn diagram, 80% overlapped.
Yes. And no, exactly. And talk about this concept of, you talk about it's easier to manage 100 million than it is to manage 5 million. I know that's sort of metaphorically, but talk about what that means and why that's important.
I just think that when you have a small budget and, I've started in my career as a division administrator, which is a subset of the Department of Medicine, which is a subset of the College of Medicine. And, those budgets can go from, $1 million to $100 million and at the college level into the billion-dollar, range. And when you're trying to manage $1 million, and you pretty much know where every dollar is going for this person and that person, for this piece of equipment and that piece of equipment, for this, annual operating item that keeps the lights on and doors open. And you have very little flexibility because you have very little scale. And if you can manage that, and I've seen managers, and I think that's the best place for managers to cut their teeth, is when, things are so tight. If they can manage that, then almost everything else is a matter of scale. And so when you move up to $100 million, then you have a lot more flexibility for moving expenses around, and you have a lot more flexibility than you do when you have just a $1 million budget. Now the consequences are bigger at $100 million if you make some mistakes, but in many ways they're more forgiving.
And take a moment on this. You talk about managers manage HR and legal versus the other way around. And this has become a sensitive topic over the years, but I believe what you're saying is completely 100% accurate. Talk about what you mean by that, because that could be taken the wrong way if you're not careful, but it doesn't mean you're not listening to legal advice. It doesn't mean you're not listening to HR advice. But at the end of the day, you're making decisions with their advice versus letting them drive the show. But talk about that.
So this was introduced to me from the chief operating officer at a hospital that I worked at. And it's pretty much a direct quote that management manages and HR and legal advise. And I was kind of junior in my career, and he was just trying to outline for me the importance of, at the end of the day, you know, it's our role to make sure, you know, the hospital services are provided, that the finances come in as they need to. And in human resources and the legal team have an important role to play in terms of making sure the institution stays out of hot water and treating people appropriately. And we have to, you know, acknowledge that and pay attention to that. But then at the end of the day, their role is advisory, and, you know, management ultimately has to really make whatever the operation is, whether it's manufacturing cars or running hospitals, be successful at the end of the day.
Thank you. And talk about, I've asked you about some of your Tomisms. Let me ask you a question in terms of rules or principles that you live by and lead organizations by. Are there a couple that you think of are your favorites or that you use all the time? Are there things that you sort of come back to all the time of your sort of core thoughts and principles around these?
Yeah, so I have a couple of them. You know, one of them is the one-third, one-third, one-third rule. Again, this was shared with me when I was, you know, just starting out in my career. And, you know, my boss was a faculty member and a physician. But he pointed out that a third of our work should be production and productive work. And what that means is, you know, what did you go to school for? What's your experience in? What have you been trained to do? And that needs to get done, and that's a third of your work. Another third of your work should be creative. How do you advance the institution forward? How do you make the place better than when you walked into it? And, you know, how can you achieve success through, you know, new innovation? And then, but a third that everybody wants to ignore is the scut and the scut work that goes along with it. And he pointed out that no matter how high you are in the organization, you've got to do your share of the scut work. And it might be fun for you to avoid the scut work, but if you're not doing it, it's either putting the institution at risk because it's not getting done, or it's requiring somebody else to do 10 times the amount of work that you could do in an hour's worth of your time because you know the material. And so none of us can avoid scut work. And hopefully we all have that balance. And in fact, when you get out of that balance, something usually goes wrong. So if somebody is doing only scut work, they get burned out and leave. If somebody is doing just the creative work, that could be fun and fantastic, but your day-to-day work and what you're paid to do isn't getting done. And if you're just doing the productive work and the scut work, but you're not doing the creative work, then you're not advancing the mission forward. So I think that, you know, that's a super helpful one to sort of outline to people and to, you know, and to remind myself when I find myself, you know, in some kind of situation where, you know, I have to do a lot of scut work and I don't want to, but, you know, I know that it has to get done.
And you find though on that point though, which I love, you find some people, particularly sometimes new people to a career, sometimes the very bright new people, think that they're above the scut work, and that's always a bad thing, a bad sign. And then you have people sort of mid-career and older that also think they're above the scut work. And the concept is, we're going to have to do some of the stuff we don't love. It's okay. We just want to make sure it doesn't dominate their jobs. And then as a supervisor, we have to be very aggressive to make sure that the scut work doesn't dominate people's jobs, because they won't stay. And they won't grow and thrive. And so we've got to be mindful of these balances for ourselves and for others as well that we work with and manage.
Right. And I think the saying is just a nice way to wrap up the three together. So you, you know, remind yourself to maintain the balance.
Thank you. Let me ask you, optimal performance graph. What is an optimal performance graph? What do you mean by that?
Yes. So it's a pretty simple one, actually. It's just sort of the difference between too little of something and too much of something. And so, you know, if you graph value on the x-axis, or sorry, the y-axis, and too little and too much on the x-axis, you know, you almost get infinite value right in the middle, where you're in between too little and too much. And so, as an example, if you're negotiating a deal with somebody, if you drive too hard, you could win, you know, maybe the stakes of that negotiation, but they'll never do business with you again. And yet at the opposite end of that, if you're just a pushover and, you know, you overpay if you're in the buying position, if you overpay for whatever they're selling and you don't negotiate strongly enough and your performance is too little, then that brings you down in the value scale as well. So, you know, it's a bit of a problem because, you know, it kind of says that, you know, there's such a thing as perfection. You know, and I do believe that perfection is the enemy of the good. But, you know, in terms of, you know, maybe identifying an issue with a colleague or a junior manager, you know, letting them know that, you know, I draw it out on a piece of paper and letting them know that, you know, here they were too much, here they were too little. And, you know, where you're trying to go is right there in the sweet spot of value. That's what that one means.
Thank you. And then, Tom, one more. Any other one of your Tom Islip's thoughts or principles that you really sticks out to you constantly? I mean, I love the third, the performance optimization graph. I can't agree with more. Trying to hit this right balance between where the cost benefit totally ends and you did the stop versus how far do you need to go to get great at something. And that's a true concept of every project, everything you do. What other rules or principles do you just love or come back to constantly?
Yeah, so some of this is just trying to interject humor into a conversation to, you know, underscore the ultimate point. So I'm a huge fan of humor and using humor. It seems like you are, you know, when I've seen you present at your meetings as well as interview people. But saying to somebody, it's like that, just different. Ultimately is just kind of a really nice way of saying that they're wrong, but they can giggle at it and laugh at it. And, you know, you can, you know, both sort of laugh a little bit at the same time, you know, you disagree. Another one is once you win the war, it's okay to lose the battle. And frequently, to be honest, that one comes up when you need to exit somebody from an organization and let them go. And, you know, once you've agreed to terms and, you know, they're going to when their last day is and, you know, their termination date. You know, if they start calling in sick, you know, a couple days, you know, in advance, people get all upset about that and they want to do something about it. And I just tell them, look, you know, you won the war. You don't have to win the battle anymore. And that comes up, you know, in other situations besides just, you know, letting people go. But, you know, I think it helps particularly with that one. And then the last one I'll mention, again, it's just a little bit of humor, is that especially in the modern era when everyone's on their devices and iPads and phones, and you know, you're trying to have an in-person meeting with 30 people, you know, and there's a presenter at the front of the room, and you know, 2/3 of the people are on their phones. You know, you're really not communicating ideas anymore, and people are just checked out. So a lot of times, I'll open a meeting and I'll say, you know, more people these days are killed by texting and driving than they are by drinking and driving. And so let's try to keep this a safe meeting. And people take a beat and then they, you know, chuckle a little bit and then they put their phones away and at least for a little while, pay a little bit more attention to the presenter.
No, and I think that's so well stated. I've been in some meetings where they don't allow you to text at all, which is challenging because I can't take being away from my phone for that long, but it's so important that you stay focused on the meeting, not on your phone, because it's so easy to do so. Anyways, Tom McGrath, just brilliant as always. A pleasure to visit with you. Thank you so much for taking the time with us today on the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. A great leader at Weill Cornell. Thank you for joining us today.
You bet, Scott. I really appreciate being here and, you know, love your organization from top to bottom.